Hey everyone, before we get into the episode proper, Kiki and myself had a little discussion about the recent news involving Splash Mountain.
Do you want to go into any, recent news? Because apparently, you and I are prophets.
We are indeed. We have the gift of sight, y'all. We know what's coming.
So yeah, we talked about this a few weeks ago. About the ride Splash Mountain, and it was announced about the day after we recorded the last episode that Disney is reworking Splash Mountain to be a Princess and the Frog ride.
Yeah, in both parks, too.
Both U.S. parks.
Well, both U.S. parks. Is there a Splash Mountain in the overseas parks?
I believe Tokyo.
Oh, okay.
So, I've seen the artwork, The tip of the mountain is now going to become Mama Odie's treehouse.
Yeah, I love that idea.
It looks like they're going to take away the orange rock coloring and give it a little bit more warmer, a softer bluish color scheme to it. At least according to that artwork, it might be at night.
It looks like they might be rigging up some light effects to make it look like lightning bugs.
Yeah. I don't know if Tiana and Lewis are going to be animatronics in that opening scene, or that's just to show that this is their ride.
Yeah, I don't know.
And this isn't going to happen.
Yeah. From the swamp theme, I kind of wonder if it's going to be, the animal characters, and if we see them at all, it would be them as frogs.
I don't know.
We don't know a lot about this. It's
all we
still
know is
the
that yeah, it's supposed to be set after the events of the movie, and we don't know. I mean, they can keep the riverboat. I don't know if they'll be keeping the critters on the riverboat.
Yeah, I don't know. It'll be,
and this is not going to happen overnight. I mean, this is not, even if they start work, I mean, they've already have in Disneyland, they've already have two big projects that they're working on with Avengers Campus and the Mickey and Minnie ride, the Disneyland version. So that's, so granted, the parks are closed. They're not really open. They decided to not reopen the parks this weekend like they were originally planning to.
I think that there are still some construction projects going on because it's easier to keep everybody masked up and distanced. Mm-hmm. And they don't have to deal with, the public.
Yeah, but I'm thinking,
so I think there are some construction workers actually still in the parks. I know that there are still some workers in the parks, but they are not the front-facing cast members mm-hmm. that interact with the public, that there are a lot of the behind-the-scenes people. Yeah. Sanitizing staff and, maintenance people and things like that.
So. Those rides still have to be up to code even if the park's closed.
Oh, yeah. You can't leave those rides sitting for too long. Yeah. Without,
they're not meant to.
Yeah, without maintenance. So, yeah.
So, we know that Avengers Campus is still in the building phase. Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway is still getting, if that's even still happening. As far as I know, they're still working on that. So this new Splash Mountain might be the third tier or whatever they're doing this to, just to not stretch their construction crews thin with all the other projects that's going on right now. So this is not going to happen, I would even say, not for another 2 or 3 years. So you have a while, whenever they decide to open the parks up, which might not even be until next year. We don't know. So if they open up the park within the next 6 months, you're still going to be able to ride the original version of Splash Mountain. Give your goodbyes to the Brer family and the little critters. If that's your childhood, say goodbye to them and welcome this new experience. It's not even the first time they've done this. I mean, they've taken the ride Maelstrom at Epcot and that became a Frozen ride. The Tower of Terror at California became the Guardians of the Galaxy ride. So it's not unheard of for them to take an existing ride, reskin it, and put in new characters.
Yeah, and this was always Walt's plan. When Walt was alive, Walt always wanted to upgrade mm-hmm. the rides. And his version of upgrade was not just like repair it or, you know, put new clothes on an animatronic figure or put new servos in or whatever. Like, he meant upgrade as in, well, you know, we had a ride based on Dumbo for a while. Now let's put it some, you know, with something different. So, you know, there are a lot of people that are like, oh, Walt would hate. No, Walt would have gotten rid of this thing a long time ago, I think.
The Disneyland that you went into when you were a kid was not the Disneyland that opened in 1955.
Also, the Disney World that I went to when I was a kid is not the Disney World I would go to if I were able to go today. Yeah. Because most of the things that I loved at the park at that time are no longer there.
Mm-hmm.
The Muppets 3D show.
It's still
not there.
Florida. In Florida, yes.
Yeah, in Florida, it's not there.
In Florida, it's there. In California, it's not there.
No, I thought they removed it in Florida as well.
No. Muppet Vision 3D is still in Florida.
Oh, okay. Well, cool. Then when it's safe again, I need to go back and see that because that was one of my favorite shows. But a lot of the things, you know, last time I was there, Little Mermaid and Aladdin were the big things everywhere. And while there are still things there, you know, there wasn't Pixar stuff when I was there.
There wasn't a full Star Wars land.
There wasn't Galaxy's Edge, you know, in there. There was, you know, so yeah. That's my point, is that there were so many things in there that are just not there anymore, and it's just the way it works. You don't, you know, but it's the same thing. Like, I went to Six Flags Over Georgia more than Disney World when I was a kid. There are rides there that are completely gone that I loved as a kid that not there anymore, or they've been completely reskinned and rethemed. One of them was reskinned for the same reason they're gonna reskin the Splash Mountain, because it was pretty racist. So you know, it's fine. I know that people are like, you know, all the Br'er Rabbit stories were so influential and they've got a lot of good things to do. The Br'er Rabbit stories are still there. What this is saying that, like, hey, maybe Disney, a company started by a white man that profits mainly white executives, shouldn't be profiting off of this ridiculous propaganda image of the antebellum South as this wonderful place where everybody got along, and, you know.
And the fact that the head Imagineer for this project is, in fact, a black woman.
Yeah, bravo. Good. More black Imagineers. They're great. Yeah.
And apparently, this has been in the works for at least a year or so, because there's apparently a couple few Imagineers that I follow online who when this news came out, was saying, finally, I can actually talk about this. So this is not a response to current events. I assume that the announcement may have been.
Yeah, I think the timing of the announcement probably was. But it
the planning,
seems like
the planning is,
they had the artwork and stuff already.
Yeah.
Already in the works.
They may have decided to announce it now for timing, but it looks like since this project isn't going to be starting breaking ground for at least another year.
Yeah. So I approve of the change. You can approve or disapprove as you like, but I think it's a good change.
I've seen videos of within the last year of this ride, and it is just not as good as it used to be. The animatronics barely function. The lighting barely functions.
I'm not sure this ride has been... people really remember Splash Mountain for the story or the animatronics. I think they remember it for it's like 115 degrees in the middle of summer in Florida. Please put water on me.
Yeah, but what I'm saying is that the ride has been in need of a major overhaul, and
mechanically, it's starting to look really rough.
These animatronics date back to an attraction from the 70s called America Sings. So these are like almost 50-year-old animatronics. It's time to replace them.
Yeah.
Let's completely overhaul it. Let's do something brand new rather than repairing 50-year-old robots. Even for Pirates of the Caribbean, they upgrade the robots every 10 or so years.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think it's a good idea, and I'm looking forward to. And yes, Tiana deserve a unique ride all unto herself? Yes, she does. But again, if a reskin ride is good enough for Elsa, it's good enough for Tiana.
Yeah, I'm fine with that. I mean, in California more so than Florida, you know, space in the parks is kind of limited.
Yeah, exactly.
So if you can, you know, reuse a thing, especially if it's a thing that maybe doesn't put the park in the best light, then by all means, go do it.
Yeah.
And now, our feature presentation.
I'm JP Tuesday.
And I'm Kiki Cannon. We've been Disney fans our entire lives. And now, as childless adults, we're undertaking a journey through the media that shaped our lives.
Trying to find out if what made them special is still there.
We are Rewatching the Magic.
Hi, Kiki.
Hi, Tuesday. Hey, I got a question for you.
What's that?
What do you think of when I say, you had plenty money, 1922.
I'm thinking, when did Disney buy Bethesda Studios and making the new Fallout game?
Strangely enough, I am not talking about Fallout this time, though you are correct. Nope. We are on to the crossover nobody ever dared dream would happen. 1988's Who Framed Roger Rabbit?
And it never happened again.
And it never happened again.
Yeah, 1988, that was a turnaround year for Disney, because it was right the year before Little Mermaid came out. So this was kind of, you can kind of say this is where the Disney Renaissance kind of started, or at least this is the precursor to the Disney Renaissance.
Yeah, this was definitely Disney trying to remind people, hey, don't you remember you know us best for animation?
Mm-hmm. By using characters from other studios.
I think this was also Disney trying to flex its muscle a little bit and remind people that it was a powerhouse and it was always going to be a powerhouse.
Mm.
Because, yeah. I mean, it was, they got the hottest producer in Hollywood at the time. To do this, Spielberg. I mean, this was at the height of his, he can do no wrong, and everything he touches is, you know, pretty guaranteed to be box office smash.
And they also brought in Zemeckis, who was fresh off Back to the Future.
Yeah, another one that Spielberg worked on. I mean, the Spielberg Zemeckis team had just made a lot of money, so. Disney likes money above all else. That's where we're going to get it. And also, this was Disney trying to merge in a slight way their Touchtone Pictures brand,
mm-hmm.
which was what they used for slightly more adult fare,
mm-hmm.
and their legacy of animation.
Mm-hmm.
Because this is, even though we all watched it as kids, this was not really meant to be a kid's movie.
No, there's a lot of innuendos and situations that are definitely not for children.
But also, even in the late 80s, I mean, we would have been like 6, 7 at the time, depending on what part of the year it came out. But
we were probably already watching The Simpsons at this point.
I was not, because I was not allowed to watch The Simpsons until I was a little bit older, because Bart was a bad influence and said naughty words like darn. Ironically, I was allowed to watch The Tracy Ullman Show. Go figure that one out. If you ever do, answers on a postcard. So, Kiki had a weird childhood. But when you're talking to kids in the 80s and you're like, hey, kids in the 80s, you know what's really hot and cool with the youth these days? Gritty 1940s detective drama.
Yeah.
I mean, even throwing cartoon characters into that, it's going to be a slightly tough sell.
I mean, at least they didn't go full at, like with Eddie Valiant doing narrations throughout the movie.
Like, that would have been kind of cool because Bob Hoskins had a great voice for narration.
Amazing, yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, they just did it on S.H.I.E.L.D. and it worked, so who knows?
Yeah. So let's throw a little one in here. Let's talk a little bit of the music in this movie. They really got that 1940s noir vibe, and that's all Alan Silvestri. Again, yeah. Back to the Future, we mentioned it. Polar Express, Forrest Gump, the Marvel movies, especially the Avengers movies.
And when Alan Silvestri is a genius. I mean, he's not always mentioned up alongside greats like John Williams or Danny Elfman even. But Alan Silvestri definitely has soundtracked, you know, probably half of your modern film viewing.
And there was points in this movie where I definitely could tell this was Alan Silvestri, because a lot of it sounded like the Back to the Future soundtrack.
Yeah, there are little riffs of that.
Especially when they're going through the tunnel from Back to the Future 2. Tell me I'm wrong on that one.
I don't think you are. No.
Who Framed Roger Rabbit, 1988. This was Spielberg's tribute to the golden age of Hollywood and the cartoons that he himself grew up with. There was a big to-do, you know, again, Disney and Spielberg working together. And Spielberg had this big rule that only cartoons that were known in the 1940s could be in the movie. I believe the only exception, I don't know if Droopy was well known in the 40s, but he's in the movie because Spielberg liked Droopy.
I mean, Droopy's a cool character. Mm-hmm. Who doesn't like Droopy?
There's a few characters in it, if you look, that kind of don't fit in that timeline. The penguins, which are from Mary Poppins, which wouldn't come out until much later. Just trying to get by working jobs as waiters.
Yeah.
But that would make sense in a way. Like, you know, not like most actors in Hollywood, not all of them are going to get roles, and they have to, you know, make do by getting actual jobs.
Yeah.
You know, 9-to-5 wage jobs. So let's just get into this, because we can describe the movie for like another 2 hours.
Well, yeah, and I just did want to kind of quickly talk about a couple of people in the cast. We got our main humans in here are Bob Hoskins, who brilliant. You know him from
the main
Hook.
Man, your can of spam.
Yeah, you know him from as playing Smee in Hook, another Spielberg project, and you know him as Mario in the horrible Super Mario Brothers movie.
I love his talking about that, how he was drunk every day on set because he just hated the movie.
And that is the correct response to that, I think. But, you know, he was also just legendary and very lauded actor and so good in almost everything. But was not, the good thing about him was he was not afraid to take parts like this. He was already kind of an actor with some standing who had been in some prestige pictures, and, you know, and you would not expect him to be like, hey, you know who's going to be acting opposite cartoons? You know, he wasn't thought of as that guy, but Who Framed Roger Rabbit really showed that he didn't think so highly of himself that he wouldn't take a role where there was some goofiness and some comedy. And I mean, it would come back again, you know, unfortunately, Super Mario Brothers, but also Brazil and Hook and, you know, a few others that he just really threw himself into the comedic bit and turned out to be a great foil, for those type of movies, which I loved. It's probably my favorite part of his career.
And, you know, not to mention the fact that for most of the movie, he's acting against nothing. Because there'd be nothing there, so you have to, you know, there's all these cartoon characters are not on set. So
yeah, kinda... I mean, it was a very difficult thing. And, of course, in 1988, actors were not used to at all working against green screens in that way, mm-hmm. Or working off of motion capture. Mm-hmm. And now we use computer effects for so much.
If this movie would have been made today, they would have had a stand-in actor for Roger and then erased him with computers and then draw over him.
Well, they sort of did. Charles Fleischer actually showed up in a bunny suit and stood just behind the camera lot of the movie. Yeah, but it's not the digital remove like we think of, like Andy Serkis is on set in a full, you know, green suit with ping pong balls all over. It wasn't that. But because this was so new for everybody, they did try something akin to that, which I find interesting.
There were some stand-ins for some of the scenes. Somewhere in this world, there's an entire cut of this movie where all the cartoons are like foam stand-ins.
Or puppets, or things on a long stick.
Yeah.
If you see the undoctored behind-the-scenes footage of this film, it is fascinating. Both in the inventiveness of, you know, cutting tracks into the floor and having weird offset trays with drinks on sticks that people under the floor are actually walking around moving the sticks to make it look like penguins are carrying them. Mm-hmm. So that actors can reach over and pull real drinks off of the trays and stuff. I mean, they really... All glory to the effects team for being able to put this together, especially in 1988. I mean, today this would be much simpler, but what we're missing is that many of those tricks kind of got their start on this film.
Mm-hmm.
Because other than a few things, there had never really been such a complete meshing of 2D animation and live animation before, at least in a feature.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, they had to invent a lot of stuff on the fly, and a lot of it turned out to be so good and hold up so well that we're still using very similar techniques today.
All right, let's kind of move.
Sorry, back to the cast. Sorry.
Let's talk about the other main human character, Christopher Lloyd as Judge Doom. Talk about Back to the Future.
Yeah, he had just come off Back to the Future and was kind of getting known for going back into big films again.
Was two around this time?
I'm sorry, say that again?
Was Clue around this time?
Yeah, Clue would have had to have been somewhere around here. I don't remember the exact year.
Mm-hmm.
But he was He had also just a few years earlier done Star Trek III,
mm-hmm.
in which he played a Klingon, of course. But, you know, most of the audience of the movie would have known him not only for Doc Brown, that would have been very fresh in minds, but, you know, his big role was on TV in Taxi. And as Reverend Jim, the really weird hippie stoner guy. And I'm not saying he had never played a villainous role. I mean, like I just said, he was in Star Trek III as a Klingon commander back when all Klingons were evil. But this was like a kind of really different character for him in most people's estimation. He was goofy. He was like very eccentric characters, or perhaps mentally unstable characters, or
he really was playing a cartoon.
But villainous characters, I'm not sure, was really cemented in his wheelhouse until this film.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, I could be wrong in that, but I don't really remember him having, other than, like I said, the little bit as a Klingon, which most people I don't think even realized that was him at the time. But, yeah, I mean, and now you think of him being both a really good comedic actor and a really dramatic villain. You know, you can think of him in that way, but I really think it started with Judge Doom here. Interestingly, they were originally going to give the part to Tim Curry, and when they saw him doing his audition for it, the producers all kind of decided he was far too terrifying, and they did not want to give little children nightmares, which I find hilarious, as this movie is cited as quite a few people's early childhood nightmares relating to Judge Doom and things he does in the film.
Can you imagine Frankenfurter in this movie?
I can imagine Tim Curry in every movie, as every role. Yes, I can. And happily, I mean, so.
Tim Curry would, of course, work with Disney later on with Muppet Treasure Island.
Yeah. Interestingly, I do want to talk just real quick about some of the voice actors in the cartoons. Most of them we've talked about before. The interesting one, though, is the voice of Jessica Rabbit, because Kathleen Turner did it, but she did it uncredited. So I'm guessing she thought this was going to be like a really weird flop, and she might have been doing it as a favor to somebody but didn't want her name attached. That's usually why people want to be uncredited in situations like that.
Maybe it's a situation similar to James Earl Jones in Star Wars. Like, my face is never going to be seen on screen, so I don't want the credit.
I mean, possibly, but I think the James Earl Jones in Star Wars probably was the same thing of, like, I don't want this weird little flop of a movie to be a defining thing in my career. And then it turned out to be the biggest thing of the year. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe don't look down your nose at awesome genre films, is what I'm saying. The cool thing is, though, is that Kathleen Turner, though, did not do the singing voice. The singing voice was done by Spielberg's wife at the time, Amy Irving.
And that was a good voice. To this day, that very breathy, sexual version of Why Don't You Do Right is impersonated by so many singers. Go on YouTube, Google that song, and so many people are just impersonating that voice.
Yeah, and she did such a wonderful job of it, and it's kind of weird because I don't really know her for her singing talents in other roles, which is kind of strange. But, you know, man, the pipes on her. Good job. Good for you, Amy. As far as the other voice actors, they got the voice actors of the time of all these major characters. This was one of Mel Blanc's last performances doing all of the Looney Tunes characters. So he did Bugs and Daffy and Porky and Tweety and Sylvester and, you know, all of the Looney Tunes characters that he always did, except for, Yosemite Sam. I think that his voice was not in a place in his life where he could still do that voice. So they actually had Joe Alasky come in and voice Yosemite Sam. But Wayne Allryne was still doing Mickey Mouse. Russi Taylor as Minnie in there. You got voice acting legends like Jim Cummings and June Foray that we've talked about before. Nancy Cartwright, Bart Simpson, as the voice of the poor shoe that gets dipped. Rest in peace, little shoe. you got we've talked about before. Mae Questel, I believe, who came in to do Betty Boop.
Yep.
And April Winchell, who we've talked about before, as Mrs. Herman, and she helped with some of the baby noises for Baby Herman.
And she had to pretend to get her butt smacked by a cartoon character.
Yeah, I mean, they really did bring in the cream of the crop. Everybody who was doing the official voices at the time was in for this movie, which is, I mean, it's a brilliant cast.
Again, something that really would be almost unheard of today.
Yeah, and especially now that that Disney is now known as the company that eats everything. And Warner Brothers is one of the few holdouts to that.
Warner Brothers just started their own streaming service with HBO Max.
Yeah, and Warner Brothers kind of is the other conglomerate fighting Disney. I mean, it's kind of a two company deal right now. So this kind of crossover probably would not work. But we've learned that whenever companies kind of put aside their individual profit and come to a deal, it tends to work out really well, especially when Disney's involved. Because we saw it with this, and then, of course, we saw it again with the Disney-Sony deal that gave us the amazing Spider-Man movies. Not the amazing Spider-Man movies, but the really good Spider-Man movies.
The current Spider-Man movies.
Yeah.
Let's keep this going. Charles Fleischer as Roger Rabbit himself. Can you talk a little bit about that? Not the original person, because there's some test footage which features Paul Rubens, Pee-wee Herman as Roger Rabbit.
I'm kind of glad that didn't happen, because I think that given some things that happened maybe in the late 80s.
Yeah.
That it might have caused a little too much weirdness around the movie. But also, I would have considered that stunt casting. Fleischer was less stunt casting.
And again, the Back to the Future connection, he was in Back to the Future 2.
Yeah. But also, he did have a... He did have on-screen credits, of course, but he was a stand-up, and he'd also started doing a little bit of voice acting, I believe, before this film. So I consider this less stunt casting. You know, it wasn't like he was a big name like Robin Williams. I mean, he was a name. There were people who knew him, of course, but he wasn't like a global draw in the same sense. So, and he was also less famous at the time than Paul Rubens, who I think would have very definitely qualified. So this to me just feels more like an actor got a job rather than we stunt casted a voice when somebody could have done it better. So I'm cool with it.
And of course, he also voices Benny the Cab and two of the Weasels.
Yeah.
One of them is very obvious. I think this one is called Greasy, the one that points the gun at him at Eddie Valiant in at the sink. Like, it wasn't until this rewatch that I really listened to, like, oh yeah, that is totally Charles Fletcher doing that voice.
Yeah. I did want to mention who played Marvin Acme, because they brought in a little bit of old Hollywood. They brought in Stubby K. That is the Stubby K as Marvin Acme there. If you are a fan of old Hollywood musicals, you know him as Nicely Nicely Johnson in the film version of Guys and Dolls, who sings Sit Down and Rock in the Boat. And you also know him as Mary and Sam in Little Abner, where he gets to sing the song Jubilation Tea Corn Pone, which are two, you know, really famous Broadway numbers. But also he was a vaudeville guy and a comedian who was in a lot of movies around that time, was a much bigger name around the time that the film is set in. So I like that they brought him in. Jerry Lewis is also somewhere in the movie.
Yeah, it's a blink and you miss a cameo in the Ink and Paint Club.
Yeah, but I've never actually spotted him in any of my watch throughs. You know, I've probably seen this movie 24 times easily. And
it's one of those things, yeah. Is that you probably don't even see his face if you.
Yeah.
He was on set and said, "Hey, Jerry, do you want to be in this scene where we have a bunch of drunks in a bar?" Sure.
So
yeah.
Anyway.
I guess we can talk about one last one. Joanna Cassidy as Dolores, the love interest, the girlfriend, the owner of the bar, which, or not even owner. She works there. I thought she was an owner, but we watched this and no, she does have a boss that we never see in the movie.
Yeah. She does mention that her boss is going to do the receipts on Friday. She needs that money back.
Yeah. And she did a good job, you know, of, especially for a character in the 40s, she's very much an independent woman, as it were.
Yeah.
Which were not very popular in the 1940s.
Other things that you may know her from if you don't recognize the name. She was in Blade Runner as Zora, the replicant. And if you watched Enterprise, she was T'Pol's mother, T'Less. But she's done some voice acting too, for WB Superman and such. But yeah, really, really cool woman, and I love her. I love her performance in this. She's perfect for this role. Mm-hmm. So.
And I of course the dynamic of her being a very tall actress and Bob Hoskins being a very short man, you know.
Well, I think they're contrasted with Roger and Jessica.
Yeah.
Because you're kind of like, why is this woman with this man? Yeah. In both couples, you know. Yeah. What's this very sensible woman doing with this alcoholic nut job, you know?
Yeah.
What is, you know, the incredibly sexy, you know, human woman doing with a rabbit, you know?
I just love the answer she gave. He makes me laugh.
Yeah. Oh, and so many theories about Jessica Rabbit, and I will get into it in a second, but
we do get it from Dolores later in the movie that, you know, that beneath the alcohol, beneath the snark, beneath everything, that Eddie is a good man, and that's why she loves him.
Yeah. And also, I think her reasoning is the same. I think Eddie used to make her laugh. Because we know that before the death of his brother and before the alcoholism and before his kind of downward slide, you know, he was raised in a circus family. He and his brothers were the clowns on the police force. All of those pictures just prove that this is a completely different, even in the pictures on the beach, he's shown like pulling pranks on her and stuff like that. So I think that her reason for being with him is probably very similar to Jessica's reason for being with Roger.
Yeah. And she still sees that man is still in there somewhere.
Yeah.
So let's kind of get into it. I think we talked about the cast as much as we could without going to every single human being that's in this movie. And,
yeah, right? there are like probably, you know, a good 70, 80 credited actors in this, but.
So yeah, let's kind of talk about the movie itself. We're in the 1940s Hollywood, and cartoons are real. That's it. Cartoons are real, and they actually are not animated. They are filmed on sets. Cartoons are filmed on sets, and the cartoons can take the violence.
The interesting thing is that they are still painted. They're not animated by a human, but the entire concept of the dip is that they are just made of paint and acetone, apparently.
Ink and paint, yeah. It's that we're never given an explanation of why the toons exist. Or how
they don't get it. They don't get into it. It's just toons are real. Go with it.
Maybe it just they drew a character and then it just came to life because magic.
Maybe there's like a genie in the book. We'll get to the book in a bit. Those people who were like, "This was the book first." We're getting there.
Yep, we could talk about it. Who Censored Roger Rabbit, the original book, which was completely different than this movie. Gary K. Wolf's Who Censored Roger Rabbit.
Yeah, now, whereas this film does the gritty detective noir as kind of a... Bob Hoskins is the straight man for all the goofiness that's going on with the toons. The book plays it, like, really straight. The book is like completely hard-boiled detective drama. the book also deals with comic strip characters and animated film cartoons. Roger Rabbit dies. Like, I mean, spoilers for a 30-something-year-old book, but you know. He dies, and the entire thing is who killed Roger Rabbit, and the idea is that by killing him, they were censoring him. I was gonna say some things, but let's not get political. Anyway, moving on. Again, spoilers for a 30-year-old book. Roger ends up being the bad guy. Sort of.
Well,
in that he orchestrated his own death to expose a secret.
It really comes down to the fact that in the book, Jessica Rabbit is everything that you suspect about her at the beginning of the movie. There is not a loving wife there. She is a gold digger. And she ends up in an affair with the studio head, which is why Roger kills him. This is why Roger kills the person because he actually is sleeping with a cartoon woman. Okay, well, just that's a thing. They didn't just play patty cake like in the movie. And
you know what? I've seen the sort of stuff people draw. I know that if that was capable of independent movement, there would be people who would be into it.
So yeah, Jessica Rabbit that people have do, that is actually closer to the original book of Jessica than the movie is.
Yeah, so
that's Jessica's thing.
Interestingly, there is a version of the Roger Rabbit script in which she is the one who framed Roger Rabbit. Hmm. That where she was the ultimate villain. There were several scripts of this written because of the way that the book goes. The book is very strange and takes itself very seriously, and that wasn't really the tone they wanted to go with. And so they wanted to figure out kind of a different ending rather than have it be Roger killing himself in a roundabout way, because they thought that was too dark for, you know, the sort of kids that might be coming along to see this.
A little too dark for Disney.
Yeah. And so they went through several things. I think the head of the studio was the ultimate bad guy in one version. I think Jessica was. There were a few. But they eventually created an entirely new character and gave him the villain role. So if you read the book and you're like, I want to see what Judge Doom's original plan, well, he's not in the book.
No.
But I think that the way they changed it worked out. And apparently so did the author.
Yeah, so much so that he actually rewrote the book, or wrote a completely different book that completely retconned the first book, called, I'm trying to remember what it was called. Who Pushed Roger Rabbit?
Yeah, it's something like that. I'm forgetting as well. But yeah, but he saw the movie and he was like, oh, that actually works a lot better than some of my plot. Yeah. And changed it to be a slightly more upbeat story in the way that the movie did, which I like.
Yeah. And yeah, so he rewrote the book, or according to the sequel book, the first book is considered a dream of Jessica, which says a lot about Jessica.
It was all a dream.
Who plugged Roger Rabbit is the name of the sequel book. So yeah, in the sequel book, the first book is considered a dream, or that since the first book is sort of told from Roger, it was more of an unreliable narrator situation.
Yeah. To keep from getting bogged down too much, if you really want to know kind of all about this as a book movie adaptation, we highly recommend going to YouTube and checking out Dominic Noble's Lost in Adaptation episode on this.
I would even say the What's the Difference episode. Also, just watch both.
Both. I mean, they're both good channels, but they really both get into it. So,
let's actually get into the actual movie, since we've talked about the book and the actors and everything else. We know Roger. Roger is the star of these Baby Herman cartoons. I love the fact that they made this so much like a Tex Avery cartoon. This is pure Tex Avery style of cartoons with the over-the-top violence that you would never see in a Disney cartoon.
Yeah, which was kind of an interesting thing, that it starts out as if you're going to watch a short in front of the feature. And yeah. I think that a lot of us kind of thought that's what was happening when we originally saw this film. Yeah, like, just, oh, they're going to do a little animated short, and then they're going to start the movie with the people and the cartoons in it.
And you think that, and then all of a sudden, we start getting the director, Raul J. Raul.
Yeah, I love that name. It's a good name.
And, you know, and we find out that Roger has been blowing his lines. Roger is messing up take after take after take.
What is this? It's a tweeting birdie. A tweeting birdie! Yeah. I love the idea that Toons can create what kind of weird thing pops up around their head when they get conked on the head.
Yeah. Yeah, honestly, do we really need to go through this movie in detail? Because honestly, I think everyone's already seen this movie. So we can kind of
This is one of the most popular movies in history. I think we can kind of skip the rundown.
Yeah, let's kind of do more of a, let's say, a character discussion in try to go that way. Let's, starting with Roger himself. You know, here's this, you know, take away the cartoon aspect. He's an actor who is not as good as he once was because all of these rumors of his wife having an affair with the guy who makes the props for the cartoons, Marvin Acme.
But you know, I'm also not sure he was ever like a star.
Sidekick.
Yeah, I mean, it's very obvious that Baby Herman is the focus of these shorts. He gets top billing and stuff, and Roger's just kind of there as the sidekick to get, you know, beat in the head. But I love that Roger aspires to be Goofy.
Yeah.
That he sees, you know, a Goofy short in the theater and keeps telling Eddie, like, oh, I wish I had the timing of him. I wish I had. And that the highest compliment Jessica pays him in the entire movie is, oh, baby, you were wonderful. You were better than Goofy.
And that line has been taken wrong so many times with this fandom.
Yeah, but in the original context, it's a very sweet line. She knows that's his dream. Mm-hmm. And she knows that they're probably about to die.
Yeah.
And she wants him to go out on that high note, I guess.
You're a better actor than Goofy is.
Yeah. But I always found Roger and Jessica to be the kind of, you know, guy who has a dream and the girl who really supports him in that, even though the dream hasn't quite got them where either of them would want to be.
Yeah. And the idea of Jessica just honestly being a loving wife. And in these kind of movies, that kind of character usually, like we talked before, usually is the villain. Or usually is a villainous character.
Yeah, the femme fatale.
Yeah, but
that's exactly the role that she would be if this were a serious detective film.
Yeah, she would be, you know, the number one suspect, as it were. And to have her straight say, I love my husband, I would do anything for him, even, you know, pose for patty cake pictures just to save his career.
Yeah, that's also how you know that Roger isn't on the top of the pile. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, blackmail or not, no studio head would dare toss out their biggest role, you know? So it's obvious that Roger is replaceable for that to even be a threat, and that Jessica knows it and Roger probably knows it. You know, Jessica Rabbit is to me, I know we started on Roger, but I really want to talk about Jessica more because I find her the more interesting character.
Let's transition to Jessica then.
I think one of the best lines in movie history, of course, it has to be that I'm not bad, I'm just drawn that way.
Yeah.
Closely followed by, do you know how hard it is to be a woman who looks like me?
Yeah, I mean, you have this, and that could be, that is pretty much almost any woman. They have, you know, a woman, a very attractive sexual look woman is going to be seen as a sex object. Jessica Rabbit in the real world, in fandom, is seen as a sex object, which if Jessica was an actual living creature, would hate.
Yeah, and there is a lot of modern interpretation of Jessica Rabbit as asexual, which I think the movie kind of brings up. There are mentions, at least, you know, kind of in, you know, weird nudge, nudge, wink, wink kind of terms. There are mentions of sex in this movie. Mm-hmm. They could have made her a sexual character in this, but at no point does she ever seem to be interested in physical intimacy in that way. And
I think it's also part of the joke.
Like, I mean, yes.
Like the imply is that she's having sex with Marvin Acme, but no, they're actually playing patty cake. That's the joke.
But you know, though, is that when she goes back, you know, nobody denies that Roger and Jessica have a very loving relationship, but other than like a kiss, there seems to be no like physical relationship between them in that way. But yet they have a very strong and loving relationship. Which I kind of like, and I don't think it's there for necessarily prudish reasons. I think it's probably there for the prudish reason of we don't want to think about a humanoid woman and a rabbit. But she also seems completely, you know, anytime she acts what you would assume would be sexual, she's kind of just talking. It just seems that she can't help but stand in what others would think of as a seductive way or speak in that kind of breathy voice. So it really does seem that, like, yeah, she's drawn that way.
She was created to be a sexual character, but her own independence is fighting against it.
Yeah. Which I love. And honestly, though, Marvin Acme also does not seem to see her as a sexual creature, unlike everybody else there.
Yeah. I mean, she said, as Betty Boop says, he never misses a night where Jessica performs. Maybe he actually does enjoy her singing.
I mean, she's, like I said, she's got a set of pipes. That's a great
actor. Or just her as an entertainer. Like, he legitimately loves her as an entertainer.
Yeah. And it is said that she was kind of, you know, she has been blackmailed to go get him into the patty cake setup. So it seems that Marvin did not want that or ask for that. In the way that the movie says.
Mm-hmm.
So it genuinely seems that there are two men who did not see her as a sex object, and everybody else sees her as a sex object, a threat because of her perceived sexuality, or a weapon because of her perceived sexuality.
Yeah.
Which I think makes her possibly the most tragic character in the movie. Although she does get a happy ending, but it's, you know, it's good she found a husband that sees her in the way she wants to be seen.
Yes. Sees her as a person?
Yeah.
An individual. Let's just say she's not actually a person. She's a cartoon. As an individual, not as a object for lust.
Yeah, which I like. That's really nice. And you know what? If the asexuals community wants to see her as a figure of empowerment, then by all means. I'm all for that. There are so few asexual icons out there.
We both have friends that are asexual, and most of them are very voluptuous women who just are seen as sexual objects by men. And it's, so I can see that. I can see, definitely see Jessica as Ace.
Yeah, I have heard many of Jessica's lines come out of the mouths of real life friends.
Yeah.
You know, in all seriousness, that this is.
I didn't ask to have big boobs or white hips, you know.
Yeah, and you know, stop objectifying people. Stop it.
Yes. Stop. Treat people like people.
Yeah.
Let's kind of flip it. Let's talk. So we talked about Roger and Jessica. We didn't mention it earlier. Let's talk about Eddie and Dolores, especially Eddie. You know, that we talked about the that one take wide shot, which is amazing, as they did do that in one take of Eddie's life. You know, him as a kid with his brother Teddy in the circus with their dad. They end up joining the police force and being goofballs.
Working Toontown, because that was their favorite spot.
Yeah, because it was full of laughs. Because they were clowns. You know, they loved cartoons because they were clowns. They know the secret of laughter.
You know, I'm gonna, because we talked about it a little bit in Zootopia. I'm gonna say Eddie is one of the few on-screen cops/detectives that solves the mystery without breaking the ethics or of the law. I mean, think about it. At what point does Eddie, like, you know, threaten anybody with violence to get information out of them, or break into a place that he doesn't have a warrant to go?
There's a deleted scene. We'll get into that.
Well, yeah, but I mean, as far as the film proper, he is kind of shown as completely upstanding and within both the letter of the law and the spirit and ethics of the law, which I think really makes it when Dolores says, "You're a good guy." You know, you're a good man. I already have a good man. We really believe it by that point, because other than the kind of picking up of the joy buzzer at the crime scene, and we don't actually know what he was going to do with it. Was he going to look at it and then hand it over to the cops? Was he going to hide? We don't know. They
number
never
one bestseller. He might as well grab one.
Yeah, I mean, we don't actually know how that scene's going to play out, but that's kind of the one time in the movie that I really caught him doing anything that I would think was kind of, you know, some of the stuff, of course, it does get violent later, but even when he dispatches some of the villains, it's not actually violence on his part. The weasels laugh themselves to death.
He does kick one into the dip.
Well, I don't think he intended to. I think that the fact that he ended up in the dip was kind of accidental, maybe. I don't know. That one's on. But that weasel was trying to shoot him.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a direct threat to his life. And he didn't intend for Judge Doom to get squished. Later with the dip, he did. But at that point, we knew that he was a murderer and... you know, once again, everybody's life was on the line.
The life of every toon in Toontown.
Yeah. So, you know, I'm a bit more lenient in actual situations of people's lives being in danger, of course. But for the most part, he does seem to be a kind of upstanding guy. We contrasted that in Zootopia with the fact that, you know, Judy keeps doing things that were like, if a real cop did that, but there's not really a lot in this movie that I'm like, ooh, if a real cop did that or a real detective did that, I would consider that an unethical way to get information or solve a case, which I find refreshing. I mean, it's so usual that you see the real world kind of scuzzy things that some cops do played up for, like, but they had to break the rules because the system was too restrictive and they would have never caught the bad guy if not for, and that's not in this film at all, which I'm so grateful for.
Yeah. And, the relationship between Eddie and Dolores, we see the pictures of them in Catalina. You know, we obviously, you know, Dolores was there the day that the Valiant Brothers opened their detective agency.
It looks like she might have even been their secretary or something.
Possibly.
Their office help, maybe.
Because it says two flatfoots and a floozy open a business.
Yeah.
And it's possible that she was, or she left after Teddy died and went to go work at the bar.
Yeah, I'm not sure that they were bringing in enough money to support two of them, because they are barely bringing enough money to support Eddie by the time the film starts. And, you know, you said earlier, like, oh, you know, for a woman in that time, she's really... But I think one of the disservices we do to history is forgetting that these women were always there. The idea of the, you know, the 1950s idea of the nuclear family, where it was, you know, the man goes out and earns the money and the woman stays home and raises the kid. That was not the reality for most households. It was for some. It still is for some. But that was more propaganda than reality. You know, if you were wealthy, maybe that was the reality. But most families in the 40s and 50s needed some work to be done by both parents. Or, like today, you had single-parent households, you had, you know, single moms or single dads raising kids, you know. So to say that, like, oh, she's too tough a woman for that time, like, no, this is a woman that would have grown up in the Depression. You know, she doesn't seem to have come from money, so she would have definitely had to have learned how to work and get her hands dirty, and, you know, she's still doing what she's doing. Mm-hmm. So, you know.
So 1947, World War II wasn't that long ago, so it's possible that her or a member of her family was, you know, working those steel mills.
Yeah, I mean, she could have very much been a Rosie the Riveter. Mm-hmm. The problem was that when the men came back from overseas and wanted to go back into factories and stuff, there was actually a problem because the women were like, no, we actually like having work and earning our own wages and having, you know, something to do during the day other than children. Not every woman, of course. But there was a bit of a problem with women being mad that they were being fired to give a returning GI a job again. So, you know, that's fascinating.
Yeah. All right. And yeah, let's kind of, we didn't mention the Valiant brothers, and really it's in the brothers themselves, they loved cartoons, they loved clowning around, and they said they loved working Toontown because it's full of laughs, until Teddy is murdered by what we eventually find out to be Judge Doom. Again, yeah. Spoilers for a 30-year-old movie.
Yeah, and I think that this is kind of one of the most hilarious and tragic story reveals in all history. Because they're just in the bar and everybody else is having a laugh and everything, and then Eddie is just such a sourpuss and walks out the door, and they're like, geez, what happened to him? And Dolores just goes, a toon killed his brother. And it's both hilarious because it's like a cartoon murdered his brother is a funny idea. Mm-hmm. And then she goes, dropped a piano on his head.
Yeah.
Which is an even funnier. Like, yes, in real life that would be awful. But in the context of the movie, it's funny. But it's even funnier because it is played as the most serious, tragic statement in the history of the world. And you're like, you know, if I had had a brother who had, you know, been moving a piano or whatever and gotten squished by a piano, that would be a tragic thing. And that's a horrible way to go. And nobody should have to go that way. But when you throw in the, like, a cartoon dropped a piano on some poor guy's head, like, I don't know. It's at the same time, it's so gruesome, but it's so hilarious. And I love that every actor in that scene is committed to making it.
Yep, playing that scene completely straight.
Yeah, which makes it even more hilarious. I mean, it's one of the rules of comedy. It's, yeah. If you got something that zany, if you play it absolutely deadpan straight, it comes off even funnier. But
which is one of the reasons Zemeckis liked working with Christopher Lloyd. Give him something really crazy and outlandish to say, and he'll say it completely straight.
Yeah, and Judge Doom has some of the funniest, like, if you take them out of context and put them into anything else, they are hilarious lines. But wonderful, the way Christopher
wonderful
looked,
billboards as far as the eye can see.
It'll be beautiful. Yeah. Yeah, that whole speech about a freeway rest stop community is just the funniest lie, and he delivers it with all the passion and dedication of someone describing the promised land. You know, it's just so good. And by this point, you already know that he is such an evil, murderous villain that just to hear him talk about what he thinks is a perfect world. Oh, I mean, everything about that is so brilliantly set up. And I don't, you know, I love Tim Curry, but I don't think anybody could have done it better than Christopher Lloyd, because Christopher Lloyd has that gravitas in him that he can be serious for a second, even while, you know, there's no camp in that scene. Yeah. It's just a guy talking about something he thinks is beautiful, and it's the most annoying thing in the world.
And as someone who has actually written in L.A. traffic, I'm sorry, Judge Doom, the freeway didn't work.
Yeah, I think that's the biggest joke in the movie, is that he's like, there will be no more traffic jams ever.
Like, have you written in L.A. traffic?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Eddie completely starts to hate Toon's. Every Toon, he just hates him because a Toon killed his brother.
I mean, we're back to the bigotry angle again that we've been talking about for the last couple of weeks.
Yeah.
I do kind of respect that Eddie stopped both being a cop and working Toontown. I mean, he stopped being a cop. He was a private detective by the time, you know, his brother was killed. But that he stopped working Toontown at all.
Yeah.
Like, he just avoided Toons, which I kind of find a slightly better outlet for bigotry than I'm going to use my power to make all Toons pay for what happened to my brother.
Which would most cops in that situation would do.
Probably. I mean, we've seen that happen before.
In real life.
Yeah. But, I mean, you know, I don't respect the bigotry, but at least I respect that he removed himself from the situation rather than going to take it out on you know, innocent Toons or whatever. But the thing is that I think it's very interesting that Roger completely understands. Not that he agrees with the bigotry, but he completely understands that such a traumatic event could bleed over onto other people of the same demographic.
He even said, if a Toon killed my brother, I hate him too.
Yeah, and the fact that up until the end of the movie, he has no idea which Toon. That Toon was never caught. Any Toon he comes across could theoretically be the Toon that killed his brother.
It's very much original Batman, where before the character of Joe Chill was created, we didn't know who killed his parents, and neither did Batman. Any criminal on the street could have been the person that killed his family. That was the entire point. So it kind of works that way.
Yeah. I don't know. I like the I like the way that this treats bigotry, in the fact that, like, yes, Eddie's bigotry towards Toons is always treated as a bad thing. Mm-hmm. It's treated as a thing that is possibly explainable, but having an explanation for a bad behavior and having an excuse for a bad behavior are not the same thing.
Mm. And it's not just him that has the bigotry. It's, you know, we see the Ink and Paint Club, Humans Only, All Toon Review.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be some kind of somewhat segregated society.
Like,
there's Toontown.
Yep.
And then there's the human town that Toons can come in to work for humans.
Yeah. it's, again, you know, this is the 1940s. This is what happened in the 1940s. You would have, for lack of a better term, you would have black entertainers work at these all-white nightclubs, but they couldn't get in the front door. They couldn't sit down and order a drink because they were black. They could entertain. They could even work in the facility as a waiter, busboy, as a bartender, but they couldn't be a patron. And that is one of the most accurate descriptions in this movie, is how the Toons are. They can work there. They can entertain there. But they can't. They can't buy anything there. They can't be a patron. They can't get a drink. Can't get a meal.
Yeah, and also the other thing that I know that we're not the first people to ever talk about this, but I don't think that a lot of the general moviegoing public, because I didn't realize it until I was an adult. If you know the history of the building of the LA freeway, recently during all the protests and reignited conversation around race, coming to the forefront again, someone has said that the LA freeway or the California freeway system in general is possibly the biggest monument to racism in all of California. And it is like that in a lot of cities. The big freeways go through the minority communities, but they lead from the city to the suburbs. But they bulldoze straight through minority communities and frequently make travel more difficult for people in the communities that the main road runs through.
And if you want to go into a different way, tune kind of rhymes with a different word that is a racist word. I wouldn't doubt that that's part of it. Wouldn't doubt that there was a community called that in the LA area at some point.
Probably, the history of America is just like, hey, here's a non-racist thing. Oops, wait a minute, as we've discovered on this show.
Yeah.
But yeah, I kind of like that the parallels are all there. The Toons are a marginalized community. They do not own their own land.
Yeah.
Their land is owned by Marvin Acme until he bequeaths it to them at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. There is a genocide planned. Granted, it is by one of their own, but collaborators have always existed. So
I actually found this out in researching for this episode, is that there is a lot of hatred of marginalized communities by their own, or at least those that can pass for white. And Judge Vim kind of embodies that. He can pass for human, or at least wearing enough of a disguise to look and sound human.
Yeah, and it is another layer in there, of course. And interestingly, that nobody ever knows who he was. That's left is the facade.
Yeah.
And nobody in Toontown knows who was under that rubber mask. That there was some Toon that will forever be kind of nameless, except for the name he adopted to become a human.
There was an explanation. Supplemental material, they tried to explain it, but it's not good.
I mean, as far as we're just taking this movie as this movie.
As the movie itself, yes.
Yeah.
We don't know who Judge Doom was. Not even Mickey, the most popular cartoon of them all, knows who he is.
Yeah, and
he's the first one that says it. I wonder who he really was.
And he definitely wasn't a duck or a rabbit or, any of the other.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to claim him as even being a Toon.
Yeah. We don't claim him. He's not one of us.
Yeah. But, there are... like I said, there will always be collaborators. Mm-hmm. Unfortunately, there are always people who are going to, and you see it with any group that has been marginalized in any way. There are the women that stand up for the patriarchy. You know, there are, you know, there were Jewish people who worked for the Nazis of their own volition, you know. Collaborators always think that they will be the exception.
Yeah.
And history always shows that they never are. They're never, you know, it might delay, you know, the oppressor coming for them, but they're never going to reach the same status as the oppressor. They're never going to be seen as one of them, because we see it in this film. Is how do the heck humans react to Judge Doom? The yeah. humans hate him. Yeah. Even thinking he is a human, he's not considered part of the human community. He hangs out with the weasels on the Toon Squad.
Mm-hmm.
And is by himself. He's rich. I mean, you know, it's not explicitly drawn line for line for you in the movie, but of course the bank robbery that ended up with the death of Eddie's brother is, of course, how he became wealthy enough to buy the judgeship in yeah. Toontown. But the thing is that the Toons hate him, even though he bought votes. He doesn't have any respect. He's just got, you know, fear of the dip.
Yeah.
And the fact that he just murders Toons with impunity without a trial. Boy, doesn't that sound like something we're familiar with.
Yep. Just no trial, no arrest. Just, you're here, I'm going to kill you right now. Even Roger says there's no justice for Toons.
Yeah. No, there is none, because Doom just shows up and is like, okay, into the dip with you. I think you've done something. And we see that he is trying to murder Roger in a bar full of witnesses.
And no one's leaving.
And yep. no one lifts a finger except for Eddie, who, you know, hands him the alcohol that, you know, enables him to get away. But there's like, what, 10 people in that bar easily, and all of them are
just watching.
Yeah, they don't even say, like, that's wrong. They're just like, oh, poor rabbit, you know?
Again, that's that happened in real life. People yeah. were just standing around and watching the thing happen. No one was stopping it.
But also, like in real life, this man, like it or not, is seen as the law.
Mm-hmm.
He is seen as the one with the official power of the state to dispense justice in however that works in Toontown.
Mm-hmm.
He is a duly elected representative, even if everybody kind of knows it was shady. What do you do in that? And that's the thing we deal with in the real world.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, in a world where interfering with police is its own crime.
Even when they're actually performing a crime.
Even when the cops are doing a crime in full public, you know, literally murdering a guy, for you to do anything other than say, please don't murder the guy, is a crime.
Mm-hmm.
To get in between a cop and his victim would be a crime.
Mm-hmm.
To attempt to grab a weapon or pull somebody out, even if you don't cause any harm, even if you don't cause any injury, it's still a crime. And so I do kind of feel for the people in the bar who I do think should have spoken up. I think they try. Should have voiced. I mean,
we see they actually try to protect Roger, even the one guy, Angelo, doing the whole Harvey Invisible Rabbit, which... No one in our generation would have gotten that joke.
I would have, because I did nothing but watch old movies as a kid.
I did not get that joke, because I did not see the movie.
Yeah, I saw that movie as a very, very young kid because, again, Kiki had a weird childhood. I absolutely think, you know, they did try to protect Roger, and that's great.
Mm-hmm.
Bravo to them. But when they actually see him, like, being summarily executed without a trial... maybe say something a little bit more than, oh, you know,
like you said, Doom was the law. It's like they couldn't,
yeah.
You know, they could have.
And we
have,
see
but then...
Doom murder a Toon that did nothing. Like he doesn't even fake a reason to kill that shoe.
Yeah.
By the way, the weirdest joke in the movie and one that always has made me uncomfortable is when the box of shoes gets tipped over and they're all running free, there is a pair of jackboots goose stepping.
Yeah.
Which I've always thought was a very strange and uncomfortable bit to watch.
Maybe they were from a propaganda cartoon. It was the 40s.
Yeah, I don't actually know why all those shoes are being kept in that box. It was always very weird to me. It just like, we need a thing to move around and distract people. What about shoes? I do think that most people our age had nightmares over the death of that shoe.
And the fact that the ink was red and his entire glove is dripping with red paint.
Yeah. It's
supposed to look like blood. Obviously, it's supposed to look like blood. But, you know, it's like, ugh. I do want to backtrack a bit. I do want to backtrack just a bit. Since we're talking about... racial and stuff. Let's talk a little bit about Betty Boop's story.
Oh, yeah.
And that is true Hollywood right there. Betty Boop, who had her own success during the black and white era of cartoons. In real life, once cartoons went to color, Betty Boop's popularity dropped like a rock. Because she could not, I mean, the studio that was making Betty Boop cartoons could not afford to make color cartoons. And when they did... they weren't good because they had now had to, because now films had standards and practices.
Yeah, the Hays Code really did a number on Betty Boop, but that's not really what we're talking about here.
Yeah, it's like, you know, she is a cigarette girl at the Ink and Paint Club because Hollywood doesn't want her anymore because she's old. You know, it's like she seems said, you know, she can't get a job because she's not a color cartoon.
Yeah. However, the history, you know, the history of Betty Boop, you know, she was based on
a
woman,
black entertainer. Yeah. She was
She was based on a white entertainer who stole her entire act from a black entertainer.
Okay. Yeah. I knew that.
And then the white entertainer, like, sued because she was like, hey, they stole my likeness and turned it into a cartoon.
They stole my gimmick.
And then, like, it came up in trial that, like, well... The white girl only got it from seeing a black performer in a club do the same thing, including the boop, little boop boopy doop thing. Betty Boop is, in a roundabout way, a stolen caricature of a black performer who went by the name of Baby Esther.
Yeah.
And... there have been, some people have tried to kind of reclaim the character by, you know, drawing her as a black woman and all in nod to that. But, you know, it's really interesting that she, you know, they make this whole thing about like, well, when things went to color and, you know, the Hays Code came in. But at the same time, like, there is a black woman out there who created an original character
that was stolen
who
twice.
Has been almost entirely erased.
Mm-hmm.
by this better known whitewashed version.
Yeah. And it's the first time in the film that you kind of see Eddie at one point having a love of tunes, because he's generally shocked to see Betty as a cigarette girl. He's like, Betty, what are you doing here? And said, yeah, you still got it, Betty. It's like there's that little bit of life in him. It's like, yeah, the world may not see that she has this talent, but I do.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is that we see Roger and Baby Herman working as actors, mm-hmm. making cartoons. We know that Goofy is making cartoons because we see one of his cartoons.
Mm-hmm.
But most of the other toons that we see are working other jobs, even really famous ones.
Mm-hmm.
There's the infamous duck versus duck scene before mm-hmm. we are introduced to Jessica. And it's like, think about it in the context of this world. Daffy and Donald are relegated to like 2-bit entertainers leading into Jessica Rabbit.
Two of the most famous cartoon characters in the world are the opening act to this lounge singer.
Well, here's what I want to know. In our world, you know, Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck and Donald Duck and Mickey Mouse and, you know, all that kind of stuff. And there is the joke about the password to the underground club being
Walt sent me.
Which suggests that Disney exists in this world.
They straight up mentioned Disney because of Dumbo. Disney loaned Dumbo to Maroon Cartoons along with the cast of Fantasia to do some cartoons with them.
But the thing is like, you know, Droopy is working as an elevator operator. Mr. Toad's working as a fireman.
Tally-ho!
You know, we see all these other characters that are, you know, just kind of there.
Yeah.
Living a completely different life. And Eddie knows them because he knows, like, Tweety.
Yeah.
When he runs into Tweety, he knows Betty when he sees her in the club and everything. But, like, does he know them because they were huge famous stars in that universe as well as ours? Or does he know them because he used to be the primary cop in Toontown?
And I'm going to say column A, column B.
You know everybody.
I'm going to say column A, column B. Like, they were working, they ended up working regular picture deals. So we have a friend that is an actor that does not get regular acting work, so he has to work, you know, as an Uber driver, as a DoorDash delivery person.
Yeah, I mean, that's normal in a lot of ways, you know. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of working voice actors who have, you know, other 9-to-5 office jobs doing different gigs, you know. But there are, you know, it's kind of interesting because other than that kind of throwaway line about Dumbo, we don't really see any other studio as a big player in the toon game, you know?
Yeah. In this universe, RK Maroon is the big studio in Hollywood for cartoons.
Yeah, I mean, and I see why they wanted to invent a different one, because
Disney isn't going to let Warner Brothers be the big studio in the movie. Warner Brothers isn't going to let Disney be the big studio in the movie.
Well, and also, if the studio head is the bad guy,
yeah,
who's going to agree to let their... You know,
mm-hmm.
Hey, thanks for loaning us, you know, Bugs and Daffy. Also, you're the bad guy now.
Yeah.
You know, that doesn't really work. So you have to invent a third studio. But what I find interesting is that there's no mention of Warner Brothers as a studio, and there's barely a mention of Disney as a studio in a kind of like, you know, get distracted for half a second and you miss it kind of way. So I don't know. I find the whole thing kind of interesting in the vein of Kiki always thinks too much about cartoons. So let's talk about one other thing that we did kind of mention when we talked about Pixar and Bug's Life. Mm. We have another issue of did a studio steal from another studio here?
Hmm.
Because the animation director for Roger Rabbit was a guy named Richard Williams. Mm-hmm. And he disliked the culture of Disney animation, like the actual bureaucracy and the way it was run on a day-to-day, that he refused to work at the Disney animation studios in Los Angeles.
That I did hear, that this was all done in London.
Yeah, they had to basically build an animation studio at Elstree Studios in England. Which is a very, very famous English studio lot. But the way they got him to agree to work for Disney at all was that Disney and with Spielberg's help promised that Disney would help him distribute his big dream animation project that he'd been working on for like 20 years by this point, The Thief and the Cobbler.
That is an infamous animated movie.
I don't even remember if we talked about this when we were doing the original episode, but The Thief and the Cobbler is a very interesting film about a Arabian city in which a poor thief ends up coming into contact with a genie and kind of an evil vizier and a princess, and some of this might be sounding familiar to you.
Yeah.
If you see a part of the animation from this, you understand that bits of the way that the vizier and the genie and part of the way the princess is drawn and stuff look very, very familiar, just kind of interpreted in a Disney style in Aladdin. And there was a little bit of controversy after the fact, not so much when Aladdin came out, because The Thief and the Cobbler was not well known among the main, you know, kind of viewing public. But this movie was legendary in Hollywood as one of those kind of unproduced films that you always kind of heard about being worked on, but it never actually got out of development hell. It ended up taking 31 years for this movie to be made.
And even then, it wasn't the movie that he really wanted.
Yeah, it ended up being, you know, kind of pieced together and, you know, slapdash and re-edited and
redubbed several times over.
Yeah, there are several dubs of this movie, several cuts of this movie. But it is kind of interesting that they were like, hey, come work for us, we'll help you distribute your dream project and we'll probably take a large chunk of it to make our next movie.
Yeah.
I don't know, it seems weird. There's a lot of, you know, there's been a lot of debate about how much was intentional lifting, how much was maybe unintentional from people who had seen like clips of it, and it's like, well, you know, the idea kind of stuck in their head and, you know, they remixed it. I don't know. But it has been kind of a long debated thing of just exactly how much Disney may have unfortunately stabbed this guy in the back after he did such an amazing job for them and made them so much money via his work on Roger Rabbit.
And like how we said at the beginning of the episode, kind of kickstarted the Disney Renaissance almost.
Yeah. I mean, it is definitely a point you could debate that this really got Disney back into the animation game. Let's talk about how the animation on this holds up and the technology, because I kind of mentioned it a little bit before, but you watched it on Disney Plus. I watched it on Disney Plus. I'm assuming you did, at least.
Yes, I did watch this movie on Disney Plus.
And I watched it on a 4K screen. How do you think it held up?
I think the animation holds up very well, especially for 1980s animation on top of 1980s live action film. And they've definitely cleaned this up from what you would expect an 80s film to look like. It's definitely a lot to do with Disney trying to keep their films as pristine as possible. But the animation is still beautiful. It's still beautiful to this day. You know, one could say is even better than some of the actual Renaissance movies, almost. The way the characters are fluid.
Yeah, I mean, from an animation point, they really do feel like they're taking up real space.
And
which I found fascinating.
Even the little things, you know, like they didn't, you know, the shadows, you know, the characters actually cast shadows. They didn't just draw them there and they're like pasted onto the screen. They make them feel like they're actually in the shot, actual real actors. And a lot of it had to do with, you know, them holding up props where these characters would be holding them up, creating, you know, using Disney's own animatronic technology for certain movements, like the Baby Herman holding the cigarette, or Roger spitting out water.
Yeah, I was shocked at how well the effects in this movie hold up. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's of course never going to be seamless where you're like, wow, I can't tell where the animation begins and the real stuff ends, which is kind of how it is on a lot of modern things.
There's some things like there's a scene where it's clear that they forgot to animate over the cartoon gun.
Yeah, there are some animation mistakes, and there are some things where it doesn't line up 100% perfect. Mm-hmm. But for a movie that came out in 1988 that, you know, really paved the way for a lot of modern effects, I am shocked at how well this holds up still.
Yeah, it still holds up. This movie really does hold up. It's a classic. It's a true
there
classic.
Are still a lot of frames of this movie, and I have seen, there was a point in my life when I was obsessed with this movie, and I watched every scrap of behind the scenes footage, every documentary about it, read books about how they did the effects and stuff. I mean, I was really into this movie at one point in my life. Even knowing all that I know about this movie, there are still shots that I watched for this rewatch, and I'm like, I still have no idea how they did that. And it baffles me how they, it's a magic trick.
Yeah.
You know,
magic. Movie magic, as they say.
Yeah, I mean, but it really is. It's like watching an illusionist make something disappear, and you're like, I have no idea how they did that. The thing that shocked me, though, was that usually when people, when we watch these movies that invented a technique, it's done so much better now that the original does not hold up that well. We talked about it with Bug's Life.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, yes, the computer animation is good, but you can do that same animation on a home computer now.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there are some effects in Roger Rabbit where I'm like, I don't know that all the home computer tech in the world, you could, you know, redo that. Mm-hmm. It's just, it seems still too high level and too seamless.
Yeah.
So I was bravo to everybody who worked on this movie in a technical sense and an animation sense, because for it to still hold up in 2020 as good as it did in 1988 is some kind of feat that I think that they made a deal with the devil or something to get it to look this good. So, yeah.
All right. So I want to, so they mentioned it earlier. I do want to mention of the infamous deleted scene in this movie.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
So, So if you're watching the movie proper, you know, the movie as it normally is, you see, Eddie is, sawing off the handcuffs, and then he says he's going back to the office. This is an obvious dub in line. In the original cut of this movie, and this is, Eddie doesn't go back to the office. He's going back to the Ink and Paint Club. He does break in, using his hat to kind of cover his hand as he's breaking the glass to get into Jessica Rabbit's dressing room to get the will, because the only person who knows about the will was Jessica. So Jessica must have the will. This is before we know everything else about the lipstick and all that. So he's going into Jessica's dressing room to try to find the will. Turns out Doom's there, Jessica's there, the weasel's there. And the whole scene is to make it look like Doom and Jessica are in cahoots. But it is Jessica's dressing room. So the weasels and Doom decide that, hey, this is breaking and entering, and we're going to take you downtown, and we're going to settle this. Oh, yeah, take me downtown. Take me to Lieutenant Santino, and we'll talk this out, because he's, you know, as it's explained earlier in the movie, those two are friends. No, we're going to go downtown, Toontown. And the look of horror on Eddie's face as he just does not want to go down to Toontown. And you don't see what happens, because it's all, you know, we don't see what happens. We never see Toontown, not yet. But they drive him into Toontown, they kick him out of Toontown the next day, and he has a cartoon pig head drawn on him, saying that he's been what they call Toonarooned, the infamous pig head scene. If you've never seen this, it's on YouTube if you can find it. He goes and he runs, scared for his life, back to his office, and he takes a shower with turpentine to wash this pig head, ripping it off his face, very gory. All these parts of pig head cartoon going down the drain with this eye getting stuck. It's
it is a monstrous scene.
This is why Eddie is pulling up his pants, wearing no shirt, when Jessica walks into the office. This scene actually aired on television. When Roger Rabbit, the movie, had its world television premiere, they said featuring footage never before seen in theaters, and they actually edited this pig head scene back into the movie, and it was the only time they ever did it. Like, they never edited it back in for any of the home releases or not even the most recent ones in the last, you know, 10 or so years.
And entire generation of unsuspecting children was scarred for life that night.
So unless you saw Roger Rabbit aired on television that one night, you would have never seen that scene edited back into the movie.
Yeah, until it was put, I think, on a DVD as a special feature, but not edited fully into the film.
You can't see the scene on Disney Plus.
Imagine being a kid who saw it for the first time on TV, and you go to school the next day, and you're like, I watched that Roger Rabbit movie finally, but that scene with the pig head was like, and all the kids who saw it in the theater were like, what scene with the pig head? There is no scene with a pig head. And you're like trying to describe this nightmare scene to like every kid at your school, and they just like beat you up and call you a freak because you're making stuff up, because that definitely was not in the movie.
I recorded it. I got it on video. I'll show you after school, I swear.
Yeah, I mean, you know that had to happen to at least one kid. You know that there was some kid out there that had like a Berenstain Bears thing.
Yeah.
Where they're like, no, I clearly remember this scene, and everybody else called them crazy. And then one day on YouTube, they found it. They were like, I'm not crazy after all. Vindication. I have to tell my therapist. Like,
vindication.
Yeah.
One more thing I do. There's a bit of controversy involving a certain scene with Jessica. I'm sure you're familiar with this one, Kiki.
Well, yeah.
Yeah, when this movie originally came out, VHSs weren't really a thing yet. Kind of starting to be. So if you slow down the original scene where Eddie and Jessica are on Benny the Cab running out of Toontown, and Benny crashes, Jessica flies out. In the original version of this movie, you can, if you slow it down, you can see that Jessica is not wearing underwear. There was a very lonely animator who did this scene.
Well, the thing is that even in the... Even when you, like, completely freeze frame that at, like, the highest quality it ever was on, I think Laserdisc was where you could actually freeze frame it, to that extent, it really is just, it looks like an animator either as a joke colored the little drawn triangle that was supposed to be her underwear the same color as her flesh. Or it was a legitimate mistake.
I mean, let's
because,
talk,
you know, I
mean, look at the controversy with the rescuers. Yeah, maybe.
I mean, it could be either way. I mean, Disney has an entire vault of pornographic pictures that was drawn by their animators.
So yeah, so
just
this,
blowing off steam. You know, I'm bored and I need to draw something to make me laugh, and sometimes that comes out very pornographic. So, but the thing is that even in the best quality footage, it wasn't like they drew extra anatomy in there.
Yeah, it looks like a Barbie doll, pretty much.
Yeah, it's really just a bit of paint, you know, color match to her skin. It did not anything really explicit, and it's very easy to believe that a tired animator did not realize that that one little bit was also supposed to be underwear and the same color as her dress.
Yeah.
They
fixed it for the Blu-ray and DVD releases, yes, but for the purposes of the original film and the original controversy, yeah.
I always thought, even as a kid, I thought that was kind of a stretch. Mm-hmm. The big, like, why don't we think of the children? I'm like, the children think you're weird. The children think you're reading too much into this. Have you never used a coloring book and accidentally colored something the wrong color?
Yeah.
But there was also people hearing Donald Duck saying bad words again. We've talked about that when we covered the Mickey Mouse shorts. People especially are always claiming Donald is saying naughty words. And
yeah,
it's
especially in this
never
movie.
True.
Yeah. I mean, they thought Donald was calling Daffy the N-word. And like, no, it's the word was little. Little. That's what he called him.
Yeah. I mean, Donald has always been an annoying character to me because I hate that voice. I really do. Even watching, like, DuckTales, the modern DuckTales where Donald is a big part of the show, I hate it because even with captions on, I'm like, I have no idea what's going on here. And yeah, they give him, like, long dialogue, too. And I'm like, Donald Duck is not a character you give long speeches to. Like, well, you give him one or two words.
The one episode where he's voiced by Don Cheadle.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, that's fine. But, like, you don't make Donald a main character with long-winded speeches. You have him shout one or two words because that's all you can understand in that voice. Mm-hmm. It's just it's a bad voice. I'm sorry. But yeah. So I mean, you want to wrap this one up?
Of Roger Rabbit, yeah. Again, let's kind of again, if you have not seen this movie,
Where have you been all your life?
Exactly.
First of all,
do yourself a favor and just watch this movie. And if you haven't watched it in a while, watch it again, because this is definitely a movie that I can watch over and over again and still be entertained by it.
Yeah, like I said, I have seen this thing easily 24 times, mm-hmm. and it's still awesome every time.
Yep, yep, gets better and better the more time you watch it. So let's ask the question but I think we already know the answer. Does this movie have the magic? Obviously.
This movie is nothing but magic. Yeah. It is magical from top to bottom. It is just an amazing piece of cinema. It is an amazing script. All the actors are perfect for it. The ability to have all these cartoon characters come together and, you know, make their little cameos. It just, oh, I love it. I love this movie so much.
I love the compromise ending, in that it was very clear that Zemeckis and Spielberg wanted Porky Pig to end this movie, but Disney wouldn't let them.
Yeah, but I like the idea that this is how Porky comes up with his... That's all, folks.
Even though technically he would have already...
Yeah, I mean, in the real world, he had already been using it, you know.
Yeah. But, of course, Disney had to have... Okay, he can say it, but the last image that they're going to see is Tinkerbell.
Yeah. Which, I mean, fair. Unlike the Sony thing... Where Disney kind of just allowed them to use their characters and I think put in a little bit of money. Mm-hmm. They got back more than they put in. Disney really did foot the bill for most of this. I think they licensed the characters from Warner Brothers. So it wasn't like Warner Brothers was like contributing a lot of capital to the film.
Yeah.
If I remember correctly. So I think it's fair that Disney could say, like, no, we're actually footing the bill for this movie. We, you know, thank you for letting us license your character, but we will end it with our character.
Yeah. So, and like I said, there's been attempts to sequelize this movie. We saw in the books, there was an attempt to make a comic book continuation that did try to explain who Judge Doom was, and it kind of doesn't work. There was an attempt at a film sequel called Roger Rabbit 2, the Toon Platoon, in which it was going to be a prequel movie where we see Roger as a young rabbit, learning that he is not human. He actually has two human parents, but he was actually adopted, which is kind of funny there. A Toon who doesn't know that they're a Toon. Yeah, so he's going to go find his real family, his real parents, and all he knows is that they live in Hollywood. Goes to Hollywood, and he eventually meets the characters that he would eventually work with. He meets Jessica, he meets Baby Herman, he meets Benny the Cab. Eventually, we find out that Jessica is maybe, or at least is some sort of connected to the Nazis. So she ends up going to Germany, and Roger ends up enlisting in the army to go to Germany.
I think it was supposed to be like a kidnap plot where they wanted her to do propaganda for Germany and they kidnapped her or something.
Yes, yes. Okay, there we go. She was kidnapped to do propaganda cartoons for Germany. Roger wants to go after her, ends up enlisting in the army, and there's an entire army platoon of just cartoon characters fighting Nazis. And it would have been awesome. Hilarious and stupid and awesome.
I think the reason that the Roger Rabbit goes to Nazi Germany thing didn't get made is because it took so long to kind of get the script and the parts in places that Spielberg had already done Schindler's List by that point.
Yeah.
And after doing that, he did not personally want to mock the war or Nazis anymore. Like it really did. If you look at his career, with the exception of kind of going back to the Nazis in the fourth Indiana Jones movie, where they are less cartoonish and more evil, realistic evil.
Yeah.
And, he kind of really did stop. There's a lot of mocking of Nazis in Spielberg's career up until he did Saving Private Ryan and Schindler's List especially. And doing those two movies were such an emotional impact on him because he had to film at the, you know, he had to film at Auschwitz. He had to film, you know, at some of these places. And according to him, it had such a profound emotional effect on him that he could not even agreeing with the fact that you should mock Nazi ideology and that Nazis were, you know, always ridiculous in some level. He could not personally bring himself to do it after standing on the site of some of these atrocities. So I think that was probably a big reason that it didn't get done while people were still like in the Roger Rabbit mania kind of phase. Which, you know, it happens.
Yeah. And this it's also one of the reasons why we really haven't seen anything Roger Rabbit in the last 20 years at least. Almost 25 years, because
yeah, I mean, there were some shorts.
Yeah, they did.
And Roger has shown up in, you know, like they did some bits for the parks and stuff like that. But
there's a Roger Rabbit ride at Disneyland.
Yeah,
but in terms of anything recent, a lot of it has to do with the fact that Disney does not 100% own the character. It's you know, Amblin Entertainment, Spielberg does have a say in how Roger is to be used.
Yeah, and before DreamWorks was a thing, when it was just Amblin, then it was a lot easier to kind of work with Spielberg. There were several times when Spielberg and Disney, you know, kind of came to agreements and worked on things, but after he sided with Katzenberg, basically.
Yeah.
A lot of that went out the window. I think it's a little better now, but unfortunately, if they did Roger Rabbit now, it would have to be Roger Rabbit interacting only with Disney properties, which I know has, you know, expanded since the movie was first made, but it's still not expanded to Warner Brothers and some of the other cartoons of the time.
Yeah. And some have even, well, let's just call that out. We wouldn't see another movie like this until Space Jam.
Yeah.
And yeah, humans interacting with cartoons, and some have said it was like a spiritual successor. I don't agree with it, but you know, if it wasn't for Roger Rabbit, we would not have Space Jam.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not sure I want more Roger Rabbit, because this movie is a thing of like wonderful perfection that just hit at exactly the right time and exactly the right moment for all the pieces to come together in this beautiful stained glass window. You know, it's like, I don't know that I want that.
Yeah.
And of course, you know, we don't have Bob Hoskins anymore, unfortunately. A lot of the voice actors, I mean, you know, Roger himself, you know, Fleischer is getting up there. I mean, let's just be honest. I think he's like 70 now or something. I'm not saying he can't play the role, but, you know, is he up for it? Would we have to recast? Would, you know, would Kathleen Turner come back as Jessica Rabbit?
Even in some of the shorts, like the later shorts, you can see hear Kathleen Turner's voice kind of deepening. Like, it wasn't the same voice from 1988 by the time we get to, like, 1995.
Yeah, and, you know, I mean, even if you had, you know, I mean, we've lost, you know, Wayne Allwyn and Rusty Taylor as the voices, you know, of Mickey and Minnie. Most of the Disney characters that were in there are, they have either recast the voices or the voice actors have passed away. You know, June Foray is no longer with us. So, I don't know.
I think the movie, just leave the movie as it is, because any sequel that would have even come out would have diminished what this movie had. And you would not have been able to do, like you said, you know, there's no way to get Warner and Disney to work that kind of deal. Not today. As both companies have immensely expanded and gotten so much bigger with, you know, the Time Warner mergers and Disney's merging with everything. So it's like there's...
Yeah, they are direct competitors in a way they were not in 1988.
Yep. So, yeah, that's all we can say about Roger Rabbit. The classic. If you haven't seen it, go see it. If you have seen it, see it again. Okay, so that's all we got to say about that. So let's move on to next week. We are staying in this timeline. We are staying in 1988. We are taking a look at...
I hope we're staying in this timeline. If you found a way to leave this timeline, I want to know that secret.
We're staying in this era. We're staying in 1988 for a while. Next week, we are taking a look at another movie that many have considered to be the precursor to the Disney Renaissance, 1988's Oliver and Company. And we might actually have a special guest for that one.
Ooh.
Yes. So tune in for that next week. So we're going to be talking about Billy Joel.
I mean, we've talked about other pop stars before. Let's see how Billy Joel fares in this one.
So yeah, so again, if you haven't seen Roger Rabbit yet, what are you waiting for? What are you waiting for?
If your kids haven't seen Roger Rabbit yet, it's good family viewing.
Even if it's definitely you might have to, you know, explain certain. Well, no one explained the jokes to us, so yeah, the kids will understand. It's fine. It's fine. Again, we're looking forward to the new Splash Mountain with Princess Tiana in it next week. Oliver and Company, and that's all we have to say about that. So,
for Smile, darn yes, smile. You know this all, or there's a great world after all. Smile, darn yes, smile, and right away, which lady luck pay you a call. Things are never black as they are painted. Time for you and Joy to get acquainted.
So all right, that's it. And move along, folks, move along. Smile. Nothing else to see here. That's all, folks!
Thank you for listening to Rewatching the Magic. We invite you to keep the magic going by joining the conversation online. Find us on Facebook at Rewatching the Magic, on Twitter at Rewatch the Magic, and of course, find all new episodes at rewatchingthemagic.podbean.com. Until next time, remember, the magic is for everyone. It only stops if you let it.